This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
It's very, very rare that you ever get the chance a second kick at the can at a fishery that's collapsed. So we have this advantage where we have roughly 10,000 owner-operator vessels in Nova Scotia, many of which are using sustainable bottom hook and line methods. But as long as you have this low-hanging fruit, this very cheap fish that's been bulk fished, it's going to be very difficult to move forward and actually stimulate real sustainable economic development in our coastal communities.
Hi and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. This week on Habitat, our conversations all center around the Ecology Action Centre, the largest environmental organization in Atlantic Canada, based here in Halifax. We start off hearing from Tristan Cleveland, an EAC staffer who is organizing an ideas competition around the redesign of the EAC's building. The competition launches this Saturday with a public workshop where anyone can share their idea for what Cleveland calls a new public space for advocacy. Then we'll hear from Susanna Fuller in a piece produced for The Tide, the podcast of the Halifax Media Co-op. Media Co-op editor Hilary Lindsay spoke to Susanna Fuller about the EAC's recent big and risky move to sue the federal government over their approval of the production of genetically modified salmon for human consumption. Then at about 20 past the hour, we feature a conversation with Justin Cantafia, a relatively new addition to the EAC's marine conservation staff. Cantafia, along with Susanna Fuller, recently published an article calling attention to the recent dramatic rebound of haddock stocks in the Georges Bank area, south of Yarmouth. They express concern that the DFO response of increasing quotas has resulted in such low prices for haddock that only large-scale fishing operations using bottom trawling methods can compete. Cantafia believes that the smart way to go is to develop the smaller-scale, bottom longline fishing industry, which he says employs more people, harvests a better quality of fish, and will help sustain the recovered ground fish stock. That's coming up later in the hour, but first, what will the Ecology Action Centre's new public space for advocacy look like? Tristan Cleveland is an urban planning advocate with the Ecology Action Centre. He's also the Ideas Competition Project Manager for a new project that we're going to ask him about today. Welcome to Habitat, Tristan.
Hey, how are you today?
Good, thanks. So you are working on an ideas competition for the expansion of the Ecology Action Center building. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about what's going on with the expansion. Will you guys be moving out of your Fern Lane location, or what's the plan?
So we're actually staying here. We have a lot of affection for this building and our position here in the north end of Halifax. We want to retain that connection with the community. And there were many, many volunteer hours that went into transforming this building back in 2006 into a much greener building. And so we want to use as much of the space as we can, and as a bit of a demonstration of how much you can do with a little bit of urban space as well. And so we're planning to do that in the next year or two, hopefully starting next year to expand the building.
Okay, so you'll be moving out into the yard or taking over other spaces.
That's right.
Now, you've kind of taken an interesting tact in terms of how you're going to come up with the plan for this. Explain a bit about the ideas competition.
Well, sure. So, you know, the first reason for doing the expansion is that we've actually outgrown our space, which is amazing, in just a few short years. One of the biggest environmental groups in Canada now. But we want to achieve more than that. We believe that if someone cares about the environment, or, you know, realizes that they are very much impacted by things like sustainable regulations, the direction of this city, the way that our forests are being treated, what is happening in our oceans. Well, if someone cares about something like that, then it should be the easiest thing for them in the world to walk through the front door of somewhere and get involved. Now, the thing is that not all people are willing to come to a committee meeting where they don't know the people, they've never been there before, they don't know what their role would be. And so we want to create a kind of public space. We're calling it a public space for advocacy. Some kind of activity, whether it's cafe or documentary space or, indoor community garden, an elevator to space. We're not sure. But we want to get people's best ideas on what kind of engaging space we can create so that a much broader section of residents, a much broader group of residents can get involved in creating the kind of change that they care about.
So the competition will be launching, I guess, on February 15th.
That's right.
And you guys have a workshop scheduled. What have you got in mind for that workshop?
Well, you see, the competition itself, that's right, it starts on the 15th, and there will be information posted on that day that allow people to make their submissions, and they'll have 3 weeks for that. But that's, really design-oriented for people who are able to create graphics for a poster, make a very, more or less technical suggestion. We also want to hear from our neighbors. We want to hear from the community. And so we decided to start the competition with a workshop where absolutely everyone is invited. And, I think that's a good idea as well, because that way the participants in the competition, when they're deciding what kind of idea they'd like to propose, it can actually respond to the needs and desires of residents that are expressed at the workshop on Saturday the 15th.
Have you started hearing ideas already? Have they been sort of coming down the pike in advance of the workshop?
There are a few ideas that that bounce around, ideas of community kitchen, some kind of tool library.
Oh, yeah.
That is a shameless plug. I'm actually involved in the tool library there.
Oh, you are? Okay, I was going to say.
That's right.
Coincidentally, yes.
That's right. Coincidentally, an idea that's been proposed by some people. Discussion groups is an idea of a bike and breakfast. So you combine something active with getting together to relax and to eat, and then discuss what we can do about something that people care about, probably in that case active transportation. That sort of model has worked really effectively in other cities. But there's probably lots of models of getting people involved in creating a really welcoming space that we're not aware of. So we want to make sure that we hear about those.
So February 15th. Mm-hmm. 1:30 p.m. at the Bloomfield Center?
That's right. 1:30 p.m. at the Bloomfield Center, room 102. And there's a site tour of the Ecology Action Center itself at 1 o'clock.
Okay, and that would be at the Fern Lane building.
That's right.
Yeah. Give us an idea. You mentioned that, that a lot of elbow grease went into renovating that building when you first moved into it.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the the green features that got added or built in when you guys renovated that Fern Lane location?
A lot of local residents were actually active volunteering, helping us create these walls made out of natural materials such as mud and cob that have a very high R value and that do not require any chemical processing. They do not require being shipped in from the other side of the world. It's totally Nova Scotian natural materials that in many cases actually do an even better job. It gives the building a certain look. We also have an array of solar panels on our roof that are, they heat our hot water. And so we have pipes that run through our floors, on both floors, that are heated directly from the sun. And then we have one solar panel that is photovoltaic that runs the system. And so, without requiring any electricity going in, on a sunny day, we can heat the whole building.
Oh, wow.
And what's neat about that is that it's as important to us to demonstrate these technologies as it is to, use them. We can have a bigger impact that way. So we actually have a little hole cut in the concrete in one spot with a window so people can see the piping that is going through, otherwise invisibly through the concrete. And we do tours of buildings so people can actually drop by and see all the innovations we used.
So it's a, you know, not only serves you guys in terms of energy efficiency, but also as a demo building sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, our ambition is much greater than just creating one green building. We'd like to set the tone for how all buildings should be done here in Nova Scotia.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing what ideas people come up with at the workshop on February 15th. And you want to tell us the location again?
So the site visit is at our office at 2705 Fern Lane. And the workshop starting 1:30 is going to be at the Bloomfield Center in room 102.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for telling us about this today, Tristan.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and RPN, the Ravel Podcast Network. Coming up next, a piece produced for The Tide, the podcast of the Halifax Media Co-op. Media Co-op editor Hillary Lindsay interviewed Susanna Fuller, Marine Conservation Coordinator of the Ecology Action Center, about their recent big and risky move to sue the federal government over the approval of the production of genetically modified salmon for human consumption. Here's Hillary Lindsay to explain more.
In November 2013, Canada became the first government in the world to give genetically modified salmon any kind of regulatory approval, making it the world's first GM food animal to go into production. AquaBounty, an American biotechnology company, is now growing the GM eggs in PEI and will transport them to Panama, where they will grow out to full size. The approval also allows the manufacture and grow out of the GM salmon elsewhere in Canada under certain conditions. The Ecology Action Center has been to court twice in its 43-year history. When Environment Canada approved the manufacturing of genetically modified salmon, they decided it was time to take the federal government to court again. The Ecology Action Center asserts the federal government violated the Environmental Protection Act because it failed to assess whether GM salmon would become invasive, potentially putting ecosystems and wild salmon at risk. The EAC also takes issue with the lack of transparency and public consultation in the decision-making process. I spoke to Susanna Fuller, Marine Conservation Coordinator at the Ecology Action Center, about why the EAC has decided to take the federal government to court.
I think we felt that as, you know, arguably the largest environmental organization in Atlantic Canada, with a focus on a myriad of issues, and this being a global precedent, that it was our responsibility. There are other GM animals out there, but mostly used for research. It's the food production part and the approval for food production that is a global first for this approval. So given that we don't have any regulatory framework for really not a good regulatory framework for genetically modified organisms in Canada. We have no labelling laws, and it is a global first for human consumption, that the first animal that we would have to be able to eat that's got, you know, three different kind species mixed together. They currently have no approval for actual sale to consumers, so they are in the process of trying to get, and it seems imminent, but we don't know, of getting approval by the Food and Drug Administration to actually sell the fish for human consumption. And their plan is that they would grow out in Panama, so they've been sending eggs to Panama, this closed containment facility, to grow them out to market size, and then they would have them for sale in the U.S. first. Because basically, if the FDA approves it, other countries will follow suit. We know from terrestrial GM processes and products that they've become privatized. We're privatizing a genetic makeup, which I think is problematic. We know what it does to farmers. We know what it does to farmers who don't even want to have the GM seed. I think we can get sucked in very easily to the argument that we need genetically modified organisms for global food supply. To me, that's an easy opt-out. It means we're not having the conversation about food distribution, we're not having the conversation about food security, we're not having a whole bunch of conversations that really do need to be had. I mean, we know how much food goes to waste in the United States alone, could deal with a significant amount of our hunger issues if we actually distributed it properly. It's a big thing for our organization, because if you get awarded costs, it can you know, it's not good for the organization. We went to court in 1991 against the Pointe Coupee power plant and lost, and we lost everything. I mean, we went from a fully staffed organization to nobody. Going to court is not something we ever want to do, but it's the only recourse in this case. And EcoJustice is our legal counsel, and we're doing it together with the Living Ocean Society of BC. So the fact that we have somebody else to do it with as another litigant was important. Our legal argument is that the government of Canada did not adequately assess the toxicity of these eggs, or it were the animals to be grown out in Canada, which the approval will allow for under certain conditions, that they just didn't, there's not proper assessment of toxicity. So that means if the eggs got, were released, they're supposedly sterile, but we don't have the information that shows what the science is that proves that if they were released, nothing would happen. One way of having a national conversation about this is taking something to court, unfortunately. There's not a lot of room right now to have public consultations on decisions, particularly with the changes in the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, which used to be the tool really that public could get engaged on environmental decisions. Because of the changes to that act, there are very few projects or initiatives that are going through that act. Somebody has to speak out on this. It is a global precedent. How these things get approved, what the public consultation process is, what the legal regime for how you would even manage them. Right now, you know, if that salmon got loose and started to breed or outcompete wild salmon, given that wild salmon are endangered and on the East Coast, I think if we don't challenge that in Canada, we have abdicated our civic duties.
That was Susanna Fuller of the Ecology Action Center. The Halifax Media Co-op's Hilary Lindsay brought us that audio, which is featured in the latest edition of The Tide, the podcast of the Halifax Media Co-op. You can also check out Hilary's written article on the subject at halifax.mediacoop.ca. You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Coming up shortly, my conversation with Justin Cantafia about the good news of a rebound in haddock stocks off our coast and the downside to this recovery, the dramatic drop in price for the tasty fish, which is leaving smaller-scale sustainable fishers out of the benefits of the long-awaited recovery. That's coming up right after this. That was Welcome to the Dark, a piece inspired by Cape Breton Highlands National Park as part of the National Parks Project compilation, performed by Old Man Ludicky, Tony Decker, and Daniela Gesundheit. You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and RPN, the Rabble Podcast Network. Our final conversation today is with Justin Cantafia, Sustainable Fisheries Campaigner at the Ecology Action Center.
I read the smallscales.ca blog, which is a great blog that everyone should go to and check out. You recently posted there a story talking about haddock. What is the story with haddock right now? What has the stock rebounded? What's going on with haddock? Fill us in.
All right. Well, firstly, that was written mostly by Susanna Fuller, who just had a baby. So
she's not with us today.
She's not with us, but here I am.
You have to do the heavy lifting today.
That's fine. I guess the story with haddock, the big deal that's been capturing all of the media attention as of late, is that the haddock is back. That's the big kind of bonanza that's going on. And there's been these huge landings. They'll go along with that. And essentially, this year class, so the particular year that these fish were born, just happened to kind of beat the odds, make it through predation, grow into adulthood, and here they are. It's a huge year class. So the biomass is up to record levels that have not been seen before. So the idea basically is that the haddock are back. They made it because in the 1990s, mid-1990s, the stock had essentially collapsed. It was down to about 10,000 tons. And now it's somewhere along the lines of 200,000 tons.
Wow.
So, yeah, huge bang, huge increase. So it's kind of response from the government has been this change in management, this let's take advantage of this increase. So the quota was about 6,500 tons last year. It's been increased 2.5 times, and now it's at about 16.5 thousand. And what we're kind of lamenting is that rather than taking advantage of the fact that we have a second kick at the can at a stock that we had previously mismanaged to near collapse, we're kind of going on with business as usual and saying, let's hit it hard while the stocks are big and let's exploit this fishery. So that's kind of the situation. And there's issues involved with kind of this mentality of getting the fish hard while it's high, because what we're seeing is a flooding of the markets. So you're seeing prices for haddock decreasing significantly, and you have fishers being incentivized essentially to continue fishing at high rates, at an increasingly high rates, as it snowballs, because they need to fish harder to get more fish to justify the low cost.
Mm.
So it's really this positive feedback loop. Meanwhile, those individuals who are engaging in sustainable methods of fishing, who may have much smaller owner-operator vessels, just aren't able to compete. The labor to go out and get such a low-value product just really isn't worth it. So we have these low prices, this mentality of this huge abundance. Individuals are going to the supermarkets, they're getting their product for really low prices. But what it's incentivizing is quick sweeps. You have big, big vessels going out and landing record highs. There have never been landings of haddock this high before. 350,000 pounds in 2 days. I've never had anything like that.
Even before the collapse?
Even before the collapse, there's nothing recorded at this level.
Hmm.
So
let's fill me in a little bit on how fisheries works this day. These haddock, are these hatchery haddock? Or is this a natural, are they born normally as part of a normal cycle out in the ocean? Or is this have we assisted in the growth of this stock?
And the only real assistance that we provide is how we manage the fishery. So this is all
so
natural
quotas.
Growth. Yes, yeah. Quota. And this is all natural growth. So right now, this time of year, is actually when the fish, the haddock, are spawning. This is when a lot of the female fish have eggs in them. And that's actually why you can go to some of the supermarkets this time of year and you can actually get haddock roe. You can get the fish eggs for pretty cheap because there's so much fish being landed right now.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, each year class is just each year of these fish, each recruitment phase has a particular chance of being big, small, or whatever it might be. And it just so happens that a few years ago, the year class did fantastically well. And what it's done is it's bolstered the biomass of the stock. But this is all naturally occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Minus the amount of fishing exploitation we applied to the fishery.
Right. Now, when people think of the fisheries collapse in Atlantic Canada, they usually think of cod. But I guess haddock stocks suffered nearly as much as cod. But was there ever a moratorium on haddock?
No, it never went below about 10,000 tons.
Okay.
But when you compare it to levels now, which is about 200,000 tons, and you compare it to today's quota, which is 16,500 tons, you could see that it was quite a low level. But ground fish in general, like these fish aren't existing on their own. When fishermen are out catching haddock, they're also landing fish like redfish, they're landing cod, they're landing dogfish, they're landing hake, pollock. They tend to swim together. Ground fish occupy a very similar niche, and hence their grouping is ground fish.
Yeah, they're not selectively just only getting haddock when they...
That's right. Fish. And essentially, the collapse came from really increasing, intensifying, somewhat industrialized fishing pressure, indiscriminate fishing pressure, so not really targeting for any specific species or not being able to target for any specific species when you do these huge sweeps. In only a few decades, really, you were able to alter the population dynamics and the ecosystem structure, as well as modifying the habitat significantly, which really put a lot of pressure and ultimately resulted in fish being overfished and your classes not being able to get to the levels that they could reach.
The quotas that are now going up because the haddock are rebounding, are these quotas that are assigned to small-scale fisheries operations in Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada, or are these larger companies with, you know, large bottom trawlers and that sort of thing? Who gets the increase in quota when the government decides to increase a quota?
It's divvied out to onshore and offshore. And then there's quota for fixed gear and mobile gear fishers. So everybody kind of gets a piece of the pie as it increases.
Fixed gear and mobile gear, explain those a little for us.
Well, fixed gear is essentially something that isn't necessarily moving. So fixed gear would be what we call bottom long line, generally is the most popular method. And that is essentially a long line of baited hooks that lays along the seafloor. Mobile gear is something that's being moved around constantly, and that's what generally we refer to as the bottom trawling. And that kind of gear, the mobile gear, is really what has been upscaled and industrialized and commercialized, and those are the individuals who can make these huge sweeps and get these record landings, like 350,000 pounds in 2 days.
And those would be what we hear about called factory trawlers.
Yeah, not every bottom trawler is a factory trawler. There's various sizes that these vessels are, but they're operating under the same principle, which is broad swooping catches and high volume. And what they do is they dump this product onto the market, getting commodity prices. Interestingly, fish prices in Nova Scotia are not dictated in any way by a regional market. There's no reflection of supply and demand regionally. Fish prices in Nova Scotia are set by distant markets, generally in New England, in Boston, Portland, or Portsmouth. So we really get a skewed price per ton or per pound kind of situation going on.
So it's not really reflecting, like, if it's not really reflecting what's happening with our local fishermen or fisheries here, that's not affecting the price as much as what's happening elsewhere?
Generally, that's the issue. But what we're seeing is with these huge landings that January provided, these huge landings generally from the individuals who could afford to do it, so the mobile gear fleet, was so significant that there's just too much fish for the processing plants to even deal with. So they're forced, essentially, to process as much fish as they can and then just dump the rest onto a bulk export market or into a commodity market. So that's a big issue. Is we're essentially fishing too much too fast. Just because we can get 350,000 pounds in 2 days doesn't mean that we should. Because if we have too much fish to process and we dump whole fish into a commodity market at low price, what we could have done was fish that sustainably over the long term or over a longer term and been able to process all that fish and thus increase locally derived value from the fish rather than just dumping it in whole. So we're losing value when we fish too fast. But because we're incentivizing and we're saying, well, you need to go out and get this fish hard and get it now, we're essentially shooting ourselves in the foot.
So there's an economic development problem here. We're sort of looking at it as a bonanza, but really we're not using this bonanza smartly.
Exactly, and that's basically what at the EAC, what we really want to push forward is that it's very, very rare that you ever get the chance, a second kick at the can at a fishery that's collapsed. You have it here at levels that are very high, at least based on a recent year class, and we have the opportunity to manage this fish properly, this fishery, and manage it properly, to market it properly, and to espouse the kind of fishing and management practices that ensure that this fishery, this natural resource, this public resource, is available into the future and is deriving income, it's deriving economic sustainability, and it's promoting coastal livelihoods rather than benefiting the few in the short term. So what we would like to see is a change in management practices that espouses more labor-intensive, smaller boats, particularly bottom longliners. Individuals who have been employing these fishing practices did so for decades without collapsing any fishery. For decades in the South Shore, for example, it was bottom longline, often generally inshore. We would like to see that espoused as a form of fishing that yields a higher quality fish without causing anywhere near as much environmental degradation. We think that that's the way that we can promote coastal livelihoods, provide a more labor-intensive yet less environmentally deleterious form of fishing, and promote more employment benefits to the coastal communities where this fishing is taking place.
This will also mean more expensive fish, though, will it?
It would ultimately mean more expensive fish, but it would also mean a fair price for our fishers. So one thing that we've been doing is working a lot on establishing a value chain rather than just promoting this supply chain throughput model to just get products out onto the commodity market as quickly as possible. What we would like to see, and what we've been doing as far back as October, we hosted creating a sustainable seafood value chain for the Atlantic provinces. That brought together a variety of stakeholders from the industry, from fishers to fish processors, fish organization members, restaurateurs, retailers, all together. Over this idea of how do we get a fair amount for the fish that we catch, and how do we promote fishing that is sustainable, not just environmentally, but also socioeconomically. So the difference between a supply chain and a value chain is the supply chain is just, it is, you know, geared up to expedite material throughput to a commodity market at increasing rates, deriving more and more for less and less. Whereas a value chain focuses on increasing the value of a product at every stage, from fishing to the plate. So that would involve the fisher, the processor, distributor, retailer, consumer. And ensuring that there are relationships and transparency between every chain in that value chain so that individuals set fair prices along the way. And at the end, the consumer can trace the product back to the fisher and actually know where the product came from. There is an increasing demand in Nova Scotia, in Canada, and the world over, really, for sustainably sourced fish. We see certification bodies thriving. All of the major big box stores, for example, are starting to source their fish from these certified fisheries. Consumers are demanding traceable, sustainable fish. So we have this advantage where we have roughly 10,000 owner-operator vessels in Nova Scotia, many of which are using sustainable bottom hook and line methods. We can mobilize this industry. We can incentivize fishing in that method to help them get a better product to the market. Individuals are willing to pay a bit more for these products, but as long as you have this low-hanging fruit, this very cheap fish that's been bulk fished at commodity prices, it's going to be very difficult to move forward and actually stimulate real sustainable economic development in our coastal communities.
Talked a bit about the price drop that happened as a result of you know the massive increase in the amount of fish, the amount of haddock coming onto shore and into the markets. Now, that I assume, you know, I'm no economist, but I assume that that is going to, the price drop would hurt a smaller operator more than a larger operator, just because there's less economies of scale for a smaller operator. So basically people, you know, a small operator might find themselves fishing like more and more, but making either the same or less money, possibly. I mean, I guess it's possible. Is this haddock boom, this like rebound of the stock, is it making money for anyone? Are the large operators making more money off of it, or is the price drop just killing the profit for everybody?
I would say that those individuals who have consolidated their fleets, their operations to fish in high amounts and get commodity prices are aggregating their fleets and their method of operation to deal with this type of fishing practices. At economies of scale, if the entire fleet was corporatized and turned into a commercial, totally corporately owned fishery, this would make sense on paper from a singular black line perspective.
Right. If just looking at profit only,
certainly
you would be able to make some money if you were just massive enough.
For now.
Yeah. For now.
But if the fishery is not properly managed, then it's a boom, then bust.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about that. I wanted to ask, you know, the cod collapse or the groundfish collapse, let's call it, has been talked about for decades now. I mean, it's all Atlantic Canadians know about this, but I'm curious, you know, to hear your opinion. Is there a widespread agreement on exactly what caused that collapse yet, or are there still competing theories? Like, have we all agreed on what caused it?
I wouldn't say that there's a general consensus that every single person agrees on. But what we believe and have the science to back up was that increasingly commercialized and indiscriminate fishing practices through commercial upscaling and industrialization really started to hit these populations and the ecosystems that they resided in a really intense way that they had never experienced before. Not to mention they were also starting to see a lot of habitat alteration from fishing practices that had never been practiced in the region before. So when you had...
Like bottom trawling,
right. Which is something that is...
Plowing the bottom of the ocean, basically.
It's clear cutting underwater. So increased commercialization of fishing and intensifying fishing pressures that weren't necessarily being properly checked really just caused widespread collapse and shifting population and ecosystem dynamics so that those individuals who came back or survived, so to speak, the year classes that went on, found themselves in a completely different arena whereby maybe there were larger levels of these groundfish. Now that their populations are decreased, slightly smaller fish that were normally predated upon by these groundfish would be in higher abundances. So the larvae and juveniles of the groundfish that were traditionally predators were suddenly the prey. For example, this is just one way that you can alter an entire ecosystem. So it actually took the demise of some of these smaller species, maybe the overfishing of them, for example, to help open up that ecosystem possibility again for the groundfish to come back. So it's highly interconnected, intricate, and fragile system that we're operating under. And just because we have this one big year that is at this huge level that we've never seen before, doesn't mean that we should be basing our fisheries management protocols on it. We can't just state that one year class is going to reflect the next 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years. But that's kind of what we're doing.
Right. Yeah. This, in fact, I guess we don't really know that this boom that happened this year in the population of haddock, that would happen again next year, do we? Or what are the odds? Do we know?
Well, the idea is that by keeping the quota at a manageable level, so not overfishing it too hard, that the biomass will continue to increase as this year class. So this is the first year that they're really reaping the rewards of a really strong year class. The hope is that next year those haddock will be even bigger. So the biomass will increase, not necessarily from new fish, but from the existing fish getting bigger. Mm. So
as long as there's still some there.
As long as there's still some there. And I don't want to sound alarmist. I don't think that the whole stock's going to be collapsed in one year. I just necessarily don't think that it's being managed in a way that really looks forward into the long term. So next year, those fish will be bigger. And hopefully, they will be there in large amounts and in a population that could be sustainable if sustainably managed. If we continue to exploit, there's no guarantees.
The quota system that we use as our main management tool, is that enough? It sort of seems like a very sort of blunt instrument, and the machine that you're looking to manage is a very finely tuned, you know, Swiss watch, and we're sort of just using a hammer to try and, you know, make sure it doesn't collapse. Is there other, you know, what else should we be doing to manage fish stocks or to manage this resource that we have that we're making use of?
Well, there's a wide range of fisheries management methods that are being worked upon, that are being implemented over time. The Integrated Fisheries Management Plan for groundfish is being worked on. It's a way of making fisheries management more robust and following more of an ecological or ecosystem approach, as well as implementing the precautionary approach more firmly, so that scientific uncertainty can't necessarily be used as a way to continue doing business as usual. But there are bycatch policies in place. There are bycatch limits. If a fishery is mismanaged, then there could be reasons to shut down the fishery altogether. For example, the cod catch quota limits the haddock catch quota. If you catch all of your cod quota in a particular season, you cannot go fishing anymore because you can't guarantee that you won't catch cod. So we see some issues here where cod's not necessarily going to increase quota-wise. But if you increase haddock quota by 2.5 times, there might be some issues in reaching a bycatch species or a separate species too quickly, and that might effectively shut down the fishery. So there are some precautionary management protocols in place, and certainly with the implementation of the Integrated Fisheries Management Plans, the IFMPs, it will become more robust.
So now, in terms of this opportunity, what is the EAC advocating for? What would you know, what specific actions would you like, I guess, the federal government to take in terms of how they're managing the resource?
Really, we want to see a more responsible method of fishing espoused. And we would like to see policies put in place that allow sustainably caught fish from small-scale fishers or fishermen to get into market. One thing that we're working on right now is institutional procurement. That was one thing that came out of our sustainable seafood value chain workshop. So we're working with universities such as Dalhousie. We've already had meetings with some of the food distribution companies there.
You mean like to get Sodexo to buy from Nova Scotia's small-scale fishermen?
Kind of, yeah, thing? To essentially get Sodexo to not necessarily be as interested in cheaply available products that come from this sort of bulk commodity fishing practice that we don't want to espouse, but to actually get traceable fish from a sustainable fishery that represents the values of the student body, as well as bringing more money into the local economy rather than buying fish that was dropped on an export bulk commodity market, shipped to China for processing, and brought back and sold in freezer packages and convenient sizes.
That always blows my mind whenever I think of that. But anyway, sorry, that's an aside. Has there, you know, the institutional procurement that you mentioned, have you had any, I mean, I guess, how far along are you in that, and has there been any successes?
Right now we're really in a development phase, and we're basically doing feasibility assessment. I mean, we've had some of this fish brought into various institutions. There's been a really positive reception to it. We've been working with the Nova Scotia Healthcare Purchasing Group and to test a pilot project that we're hoping to get underway quite soon, involving 16 healthcare facilities from Yarmouth to Wolfville. And basically what we're looking to do is to work with these assisting care facilities, nursing homes and hospitals, to get locally sourced fish into the institutions. And we've done capacity mapping whereby we've shown where hook and line fish is being landed, where the fish processing plants are, and where the institutions are, to show on a map that it's feasible. And then what we can start to do is to start to divert some of their input, some of their fish consumption, and replace it with our fish. Fresh, locally sourced, traceable, sustainably caught fish. And one thing, when we're talking about fish prices inevitably going up when you're not buying at a bulk level, There are fish now that are being landed at such low values that there is no incentive really whatsoever to keep them, although it is legally required to land all fish. We think of a species like hake or mackerel. A lot of these species capture so little per pound that they're not necessarily worth doing anything with other than treating them as bait.
Really? So I guess they would be caught like as bycatch with something else, but then once you get them ashore, it's not even worth driving them to a processing plant or...
Yeah.
Wow.
Generally, they're just salted and iced up and treated as bait and kicked around and, you know, pitchforked here and there. Whereas we know of individuals as far
delicious
as
mackerel.
Delicious mackerel. There are people in Toronto who are willing to pay $10+ a pound. But here, when they maybe are only getting 30 cents a pound, 15 cents a pound, something incredibly low. So we don't necessarily need to ship all the mackerel out to Toronto.
That sounds like how much my grandmother paid for fish, like at the dock when she was a girl. Wow. Okay.
But one thing that we can do when we see these really low prices, that is really disincentivizing individuals from keeping these fish or even trying to try their luck on the market, is finding institutions, for example, being one source of consumption that would want to have this fish. Mackerel is a heart-healthy species that's high in the essential oils that could be brought into nursing homes, for example, and used as a very healthy source of protein for residents or even in hospitals at very affordable rates. Just increasing the value a little bit could suddenly make it worth it for these fishermen to target the species or at least treat it as food rather than bait or trash.
All right, Justin, well, thanks so much for telling us about this today.
Oh, no problem.
Where can people find out more or read the piece that you and Susanna Fuller wrote?
It's available on the Ecology Action Center's marine blog, which is called Small Scales. That can be found at www.smallscales.ca.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM. HabitatRadio.ca and Rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.